Welcome to Listen In. I'm Brian Gahan, and this podcast focuses on the stories that are buried deep inside all conversations. Be it the kind of conversation you have with someone whose life experience is full of interesting POVs and insights, or the kind of conversation you have inside your own head around your own life experiences. Today in episode 23, I'm talking with award-winning author and social commentator Alan C. Logan. Alan's back to talk all things post-truth, how its prevalence is affecting the health continuum of person, place, and planet, and the importance of teaching power dynamics and propaganda construction to our youth. He introduces us to his new book, The Greatest Hoax on Earth, Catching Truth While We Can, and how it reveals the massive hoax that fostered a billion-dollar entertainment franchise. Well, hello, Alan. Welcome back to Listen In.
I really appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you again, Brian.
Yeah, I have to admit, I love talking to you. And I love it because I think that your journey, your personal journey, sort of encapsulates, you know, exactly where we are right now, you know, when it comes to our sort of social struggle around the truth. You know, and I'm not just talking about the work you're doing right now. I'm talking about the work you've done in the past, your work with nature, health, the microbiome, you know, then how that led you to that fascinating story with Dr. Robert Vernon Spears and the whole uncovering of his cons that he was doing that you outlined in your last book, Self-Styled, you know, chasing Dr. Robert Vernon Spears. And then how it sort of landed you here where you are today talking to me about your new book, which is, again, fascinating and takes another look at truth and how we absorb it or deflect it as a culture. And, you know, that book being The Greatest Hoax on Earth, Catching Truth While You Can. And I think it would be like so easy if we were just to look at your last two books to sort of, you know, label you as a really good investigative reporter. And I think that would be, it would be completely true. I mean, you've done an amazing job. You investigate things right through and you sort of pull back the curtain and show us the truth in a very entertaining and also engaging way. But I also see it a little bit more like, you know, you're a truth seeker, but you're sort of fascinated and you've dedicated a lot of your career to uncovering how truth and the lack of truth affects our health and our well-being. And that's why I'm so excited to have you back on Listen In. And that's why I'm so excited to talk to you today, because that's kind of, for me, where the rubber hits the road. You know, that's the part where, you know, what's going on in our post-truth world and how is that affecting our ability to stay safe and healthy and improve our well-being? So with no further ado, let's just jump in and have a conversation around that. I mean, I alluded to the fact that your books, you know, you've done two books now on con artists. And so, you know, we won't go too much into your latest book because we don't want to give it away. We want people to uncover that story, how it's meant to be uncovered through reading it. But what in your journey, in your work, what's the connection that you see between, you know, the con artist and our love? You know, we've got one almost out of the White House, but we have one sitting in the White House right now. And what our fascination with that and our sort of inability to embrace what's the truth line right in front of our face, so to speak?
Well, I think the popularity of con artists, confidence men, if you will, true crime on Netflix and elsewhere, you know, these fallen gurus, you know, that are extremely popular, documentaries as well. I think it just all sits in a larger context of what's called post-truth, which was the 2016 word of the year by Oxford Dictionaries. And I think when you peel back what post-truth really means, you really kind of, you start to see the connections that exist, and we're at such a critical juncture. I mean, you can learn a lot of lessons from the activities of confidence men as they sit in this larger context of all of the problems facing our planet at the moment, right? The Anthropocene, there's a syndrome with it, right? Whether it's about grotesque biodiversity losses, inequalities, unprecedented, climate change, of course. But many things. We have our pandemic, non-communicable diseases, and we're living in what the World Health Organization describes as an infodemic. So we not only have a pandemic, we have an infodemic of misinformation and post-truth. When you start to sort of look at what was that marker in the sand, you know, if you were a geologist and you were looking for the marker and you had a clear slice of land and you say, okay, where did post-truth really begin? Which is to say, you know, I think, well, first of all, let's just kind of identify how post-truth is described, because I think that's really important as a context for some of the conversations we may have. And, you know, it's really described initially by Oxford as the circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So you can take that sentence and you can actually put it right in, hand in glove, to the way in which confidence men operate, right? And how they get away with what they can. Appeals to emotion, right? Mm-hmm. More important than facts. And more specifically, you know, science writers like Kathleen Higgins took it, the definition, to a way that I feel is actually more relevant. The listeners may appreciate this definition a little bit better, and that is that post-truth refers to blatant lies being routine across society, and that public tolerance of inaccurate and undefended allegations in response to hard questions and outright denials of facts is shockingly high. Mm-hmm. But this isn't something that just happened, you know, in 2016. Scientists, of course, sat a bolt upright in 2016 and began to study it. But the fact is, post-truth as a term was coined in the early 1990s. And you start to see these things really taking shape, Brian, in the mid-1970s, 1980s, when you have immense power by multinational corporations and marketing, where everything becomes image. And, you know, you start to see, well, what's real and what's not real. And I think you know, a post-truth and things like fake news. Fake news is not a new term. Harper's Magazine forewarned by name a crisis of what they called, quotes, fake news mm-hmm. in 1925. It's just that we've gotten to a point, and I think this is the distinction, where there's a lack of, it's almost as if the we care less about it. I mean, that's what Ralph Keyes, the author of the book Post-Truth, described this transition, where it's like we normally care about it. As he said, deception has become a modern way of life, where once the boundary line between truth and lies was clear and distinct, it is no longer so. In the post-truth era, deceiving others has become a challenge, a game, a habit. So I think it's the point where you start to talk about really not caring as much, because image is all around us. And when one of the New York Times critics, Barbara Goldsmith, stated that, you know, what is image and what is real? Can we answer? And she quoted what I think is really important. And this is, again, in the mid-70s. And she said that, I remember reading somewhere that almost half of the people polled after the 1972 moonwalk did not believe that it actually occurred. They thought they were watching a television simulation. And we have seen too many simulations, and the emotional signposts that once marked the road to truth have been obliterated, because everything's been blended into one. Now take that and put it on steroids with social media and the rapid fire exchange of information. You know, again, as mentioned, Brian, post-truth is not new. You could argue that, you know, fake stories have been traded throughout our entire existence in humanity's history going back. But it's actually now the concern is the level and the ease and the speed at which it occurs instantly at just hitting the enter button on your phone or on your keyboard. And that's how quickly it spreads.
I was doing some reading around the concept of truth, and that famous saying from the Bible, the truth shall set you free. At that time, we had kings and queens and churches, and we had very few sort of either institutions or people that were lying to us, let's say, in order to manipulate us. And then as that broke down and we had the rise of the corporations, and the corporations, as you say, and the image makers and the marketing and the sort of information age, all of a sudden it's sort of everywhere. And so now it's like, it's not just, oh, I don't trust, the church, or I don't trust the government, or it's now, I don't know if I trust anybody, sort of thing,
Yeah,
right?
no, it's true, and that you're getting to the heart of it, and that's you can argue, I think with some ease, that that is a lot to do with how polarized we've become. Because the research is clear, Gene Twenge just has and others have looked at the way we're polarized in our politics in the last 30 years, never more than we are now, and so. I guess what's happened also is the ease at which you can find others in echo chambers that share exclusively your own points of view. And there's, because, really a lot of this, the spread of misinformation at its root, if you really break it down, it's about anxiety and fear as an emotion, I think. And when you live in an echo chamber bubble, it soothes that. You feel when you get the messages that resonate with you and our own cognitive biases, then it's a soothing balm, really. And you can find that. It's very easy to turn on a particular cable channel, to go into a particular social media confine and have your personal beliefs reflected back to you. And we're all subjected to our own cognitive biases based on our experiences, our total lived experience, as it's called. So that's also changed. It's very easy. Let's just use the comical aspect of this, which would be sort of flat Earth society. But think about it on grander scales, other than just flat Earth. But just using that as an example, it's very easy for individuals who adhere to that to find each other now. And then that's what's dramatically changed. Whereas before, you really kind of didn't have that much. Yeah, there was little newsletters and things like that. But now you can actually bring together people with set beliefs, rigid beliefs, and they can find each other with ease.
Right. And so, I guess we're living through the evolution of the truth of who we really are, which is potentially we are a species who doesn't really want to know the truth.
Yes, yeah, so I think that's a really great question. I mean, I think sometimes we don't, and I think we believe we're storytellers, human beings, and this is cross-cultural. You can go to any culture throughout the world, and researchers have found we are a storytelling species. And in fact, if you look at the few remaining traditional hunter-gatherer groups that exist today, even today, which was, sort of a surrogate marker of our ancestral past, even today, the skilled storytellers are highly prized among those groups. And in fact, even more so than the most effective forager. The prized individual in a hunter-gatherer society is the skilled storyteller. And that really tells you a lot because, there's elements of entertainment in there. There's elements of, myth, and that's okay. Myth is a good thing if it's used properly, right? It can be inspiring. It can lead to an appropriate level of cohesion. There's nothing wrong with our past as being storytellers, but the problem is when outright lies are traded, in the public square without any kind of care, then you end up getting extreme polarization, beliefs that are dangerous, unhealthy, because I think that you and I, we like to talk about health. So you just bring it back to the state of the health, right? And health is always sits on a continuum from person, place to planet, you know, and the health consequences, you know, whether it be related to climate change, whether it be related to the spread, the other pandemic that we don't talk about, which is of non-communicable diseases, that it's being uncovered with the current COVID pandemic, you're seeing that non-communicable diseases are setting people at much greater risk for hospitalization, for severity of COVID, for mortality. And then you can just follow that line out, and who carries the greatest burden of the non-communicable diseases? It's disadvantaged individuals and groups. So you start to see this spread of unhealthy product around the world, because again, you keep following it out on a line, you start to see the connections between non-communicable diseases and unhealthy product, whether it's tobacco, you know, alcohol, ultra-processed foods, and so on, the marketing of a sedentary lifestyle. And once again, you know, that's now spreading like a plague globally, and it's pushing down the hardest on the disadvantaged. So, you know, these things are unhealthy, and the messages that support them are, and the other thing I'll just say now at this juncture, because I'm sure that you want to, you got lots to talk about too, but if I can just say that quite often the construction, the framework of propaganda, which we tend to think of as the type of thing that despots and demagogues use, but actually propaganda framework, scaffolding, is the same throughout the marketing of unhealthy products as it would be for someone thumping, you know, a podium in a political sense too. The techniques are quite similar, believe it or not.
Well, I mean, and that's when you say it's not new. I mean, I came across a quote when I was looking up the concept of post-truth and, you know, the whole, you know, the sort of narcissistic and the con artist and that sort of thing. And, you know, and there's a couple that come up, you know, one is that a lie told once is a lie, but if it's told 1,000 times, it becomes the truth.
Yes.
And then even Hitler, you know, in Mein Kampf wrote, you know, the most brilliant propagandist technique will yield no success unless one fundamental principle is born in mind constantly. It must confine itself to a few points and repeat them over and over.
Yeah, that's right. And the research, the science, because I guess the one upside of 2016, as I said earlier, that scientists, researchers sat up bolt upright and said, hey, we got to start studying this. And what's you see clearly in reference to what you've just now said is that repetition absolutely solidifies misinformation. And in fact, the more something's repeated, even when presented with the actual corrected information, it's very difficult to eradicate misinformation or disinformation, which is the intentional spread of falsehoods. It's very difficult to eradicate it once something's been repeated enough. So you're bang on with that in terms of the science of it. And, you know, it's something that I think we all really need to take very seriously right now. You know, this is something that over the next really 5-10 years, we really have to come to grips with. Because going back to the spread, because now, okay, so think about what you just now said about spreading the lie through repetition, right? Mm-hmm. And think about how easy that is with social media and the rapid nature with things fly on our major social media channels, right? And how easy that it gets repeated, solidified, presented with new information. It's very difficult to eradicate it, even when individuals are presented with correct information. So, you know, and then we take that and bring it in now to Neil Postman's, you know, multi best-selling book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, wherein he argued that post sort of mid-century modern Americana, everything became image, but it also became entertainment. Think away the way our politics these days is a form of entertainment, right? Mm-hmm. Pithy little things on Twitter and so forth. There's an amusement factor there, and that also solidifies misinformation. When you combine misinformation with a bit of amusement, it's more likely to stick. And put another way, you're less likely to be skeptical about the information that's presented to you. Marketers have known this for years, of course. Any salesman has known this. They put you in a little bit of a good mood, and especially through, you know, some form of amusement, and you're less likely to have your guard up about misinformation or a sales pitch. It all sits on a continuum, right?
Welcome back. I'm talking with award-winning author Alan C. Logan, who is sharing his journey that led to his new book, The Greatest Hoax on Earth, Catching Truth While We Can, and what it taught him about our post-truth world. When you talk about sort of the use of social media and the ability for us to connect and spread mistruths so quickly and say them over and over and over again, it brings me to this point that I came across where this one researcher was saying that, you know, people prefer power over the truth.
Yeah.
And so if you're, you know, got your tinfoil hat on and, you know, and you're on your computer late at night and you're believing in some conspiracy theory and you go out into the world and you find, you know, 1,000 more people like yourself, it gives you some sense of power. And so that sense of power is more valuable in our society to you than actually knowing the truth. And so you fight tooth and nail to hang on to the power you have, whether it's a truth or not, just because you want that power. And you will deflect anything that might uncover the fact that what you believe in is not true.
And yeah, I think that's so important, what you just now said.
Yeah.
And sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's totally okay. And I think that that's what we've seen so obviously put in front of us in the Trump era, is that the need to hang on to power is so strong that his followers and supporters, right through to, you know, the people in the Republican Party that should be standing up to him and who haven't, it's because power is more valuable in our society over truth. And that's a really sad, sad state.
It's a sad state, Brian. And it is also true that people, once they maintain beliefs and they build them, quite often they are very resistant to, because in some sense also, so there's just that rote craving and hunger for power, right? Which gets into social dominance orientation and why it is that people have authoritarian aspects of personality and so forth. There's a rich area of research there. But you also have just the inability of human beings to sort of say, you know, I was wrong, and correct and update their information. Now, thankfully, you know, there is that point. Otherwise, everyone would believe that there's a flat earth, to use the, you know, the parable, if you will.
Right.
But we do. I mean, and it's so important for human progress that we do update our beliefs based on, you know, because this takes us back to narrative and myth and storytelling. We've always told stories quite often to curb our anxiety. Amusement, yes, but essentially to make the world a less frightening place. And along the way, with the introduction and of science, we've begun to see things in incredible ways and update our beliefs based on science, based on new knowledge. And it's really important to do that. But, you know, again, I think what you're getting at there is really important. So there's the power aspect, there's the inability to say, hey, let me update my beliefs because there's enough information now available for me to do that. And there's a multitude of examples along the way, thankfully, that most people do that. It's just that right now with social media, it's so easy to get entrenched into various camps. Keep on repeating. And again, what you've described before about the repetition of claims being likely to be true, it's called illusory truth. It's an illusion of truth. You just keep repeating it. And it's also worth noting that holding on and clamping into your beliefs because you're afraid to let them go or you refuse to, you know, to update your beliefs. There's a saying attributed to Twain, you know, and it's easier to fool people than it is to convince them that they have been fooled.
Right.
And I think that takes us into our admiration of con men to a degree. You know, quite often people don't want to acknowledge that they've been conned. So there's that aspect of it. So think about how everything we've been talking about so far is sort of sits on a continuum, right? So we mentioned that health sits on a continuum from person to place, meaning community and the planet itself. But it's also true in the area of sort of confidence men that it always sits on a continuum as well. And if people are kind of victimized, for lack of a better word, they don't want to concede that. You don't want to, you know, again, to repeat the phrase, it's easier to fool people than it is to convince them that they have been fooled. So yeah. No one wants to concede that, yeah, I got taken in, you know, by a demagogue or, you know, by a con man. So, you know, yeah. Whether it's some guy that's doing a shell game in the street or on larger scales, we just don't want to concede that.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I had somebody who I knew in my life who told a lot of lies. And I and they both knew that they told a lot of lies. And one day in conversation, I just came right out and I said to them, I said, you know, why do you lie so much? And the answer back shocked me, but it shouldn't have surprised me. And the answer back was, as a small child, I learned if you lie, you will get caught. But I then learned as I got older, if you tell a really huge lie, people will believe you. And so therefore, you don't just lie, you tell these grandiose, huge lies, and you will get away with it. And that's exactly, I think, ties into sort of the con man, but it also ties into what you said about Twain's quote about not wanting to be acknowledge that you've been duped is yes. That because usually it's a really huge thing that has happened to you. It's not like somebody came up to you and lied and said they didn't have change for the bus and, you know, got $3 off of you or something like that. It's usually, you know, some amazing thing. And so the people end up just sort of going along with it because it's one, too much work to prove it is a huge lie, and two, it's going to shed some light on who they are and how gullible they are. And so that takes us right into a nice segue into the work you've done on, you know, I mean, I don't know how it'll get summed up, but to me, it's sort of like your book is sort of the peeling back of the real truth around one of the most famous, I would say, modern day con artist stories.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, I guess there would almost be intrigue in leaving the individual nameless at this juncture, because it'll be very easy for anyone that's so inclined to find out after they're done listening to this, who it is it referring to. But suffice it to say that between a New York Times bestseller, a colossal blockbuster Hollywood film, and a Broadway play that won a Tony, this is a $1 billion franchise that's sort of based upon really a con man that nothing is as it appears to be. And I think it really gets to the heart of where we are at right now, because it combines everything that we've talked about thus far, especially image. If you say something and repeat it often enough, it becomes accepted to be true. I have learned along the way that there are many people that do not want this to not be true. If you get
I can bet. Like, yeah,
I can tell you, with to use the term confidence, that there are many who just do not want this to not be true. It's like saying there's no Santa Claus, and in fact, one person who read the manuscript said just that you've essentially written a book that says there's no Santa Claus. Reader beware, if you will. And the lawyer, who's an expert in copyright and libel and all that, of course, because I had this manuscript vetted from cover to cover. When he wrote back to me after reading the manuscript, he didn't have any words. He just wrote back 4 massive exclamation points. And then subsequently in the follow-up email, stated what you and I have been saying, that mm-hmm. it's a parable of our times, because really it just cuts into it. This is, you know, there's plenty of books about con men, but we really need to start looking at these stories in the context of the post-truth world in which we live in, because it's essential for our progress and for many of the things that you and I have been talking about. And, you know, yeah. I think the other thing that we didn't bring up, but you did just now, and that is, you said something I think that's really important to pull out for the listeners. And that is, it's cognitively demanding. It takes a lot of effort to investigate. And when someone, as you described this anecdote that you described in your own personal life, and I'm sure many who hear that will say, yep, I've had quite a few, or at least some people just like that, who have told these outlandish tales.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often there's grains of truth built in there, because that's the case. A lot of times these big stories do have grains of truth in them. And that's what allows it to be magnified. It's almost like assembling a couple of grains of truth allows for the colossal, holistic falsehood, if you will,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is what they do. And they build in these tiny fragments of truth around it. And then it takes a lot of work to try to start debunking the aspects of that are not true. It's cognitively taxing. There's a lot of research on this. So the human, for our very survival, because we don't have the energy to devote to debunking everything that's around us, human beings are generally very trusting, you know, and in the end, that's the default mode that has mostly served us well. Throughout our history as a species. But that's the point of leverage that they get into. And that cognitive demand is also, in our modern era, Brian, really worsened by distractions, mm-hmm. because we live in the age of distraction. And it's very easy. So think about how, okay, let's always go back now to our conversation that everything sits on a continuum.
Right.
So think about how the shell game operator works in the street. They ultimately win the game because of distraction. There's always a magician does that all the time. They look at him rise. Where are the wires? There's a distraction going on. And in the shell game, that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with what's happening now on the larger scale throughout society. Person, place, planet. Distractions. We are living in the age of distraction, and researchers have shown that when you increase levels of distraction, so these are experimental studies. You present people with various pieces of information, information processing for decision making. Distractions lead to falsehoods being included in decision making as if they were factual. And this is even sometimes when things are labeled as misinformation up front. Mm-hmm. I think one time when you and I chatted, we talked about these research studies are really intriguing, where they intentionally distract subjects in the study. They're told up front, hey, look, there's information in red ink in this story you're about to read. There's information in red ink that you should avoid. It's untrue. Don't pay it any mind. So they're given this information up front.
Mm-hmm.
But yet when they're distracted as they read the information, they don't ignore the red ink. They believe it to be true. And in the studies that we're talking about here, these are experimental, hypothetical studies. But what was at play here was the sentencing of, you know, air quotes, experimental perpetrators, and the distracted subjects gave the individuals, based on information they should have ignored, twice as long of sentences than the individuals who were not distracted. So think about the implications to society with that.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about the way that the shell game operates, the distraction operates in our inability. It's hard enough cognitively to separate truth from fiction at the best of times, but it's increasingly hard when we're faced with so many distractions as we try to weed through disinformation, misinformation, propaganda.
Yeah, and in the con artist, I mean, a lot of con artists are very charismatic people. And so they come in and just their charisma is distracting to the people around them. And so they don't, as you say, they don't read the red ink. They
Yeah,
just.
exactly.
But
Exactly. Exactly.
something you said, and I thought, oh, this is interesting because I've always struggled to try and figure out my interactions with narcissists and how their brains work. And I've had a couple of sort of professionals say to me, well, don't even try because they think differently than you. Like they're you would never ever draw the same conclusion as them. And but in some of the research that I've done around con artists and this sort of thing and the idea around as you mentioned, you brought up the fact that there's always an element of truth in what they say.
Yes.
Is it's almost like they take a seed of, oh, this just happened. I can profit from this. And then they build on it. And that's how their brains work a little differently than the average person is they're very opportunistic. They're like, ooh, that just happened. I could take that story, I can add this and this and this to it, and now I can sell that as something that makes me either look good or gives me advantage or gets somebody to do something I want them to do for me. And I saw this happen once. I was with a friend and we were driving to a retail store and I told him a story about something that had happened to me and why I was excited to go to this store because I wanted to see if they had a product that would help with this situation.
Right.
And we walk in the store and my friend goes up to this person that owns the store and starts to tell them my story as if it had happened to them.
Oh, man.
And like right in front of me,
Oh, man.
in order to have this, I guess what he would get, which was some sort of gratification of being somebody who had had this issue and et cetera, right? And I remember at that time just being so fascinated, going like, how can you do that? Like, I mean, right in front of, it's one thing you do that and I'm not here. It's another thing you're doing it in front of me, but you're also completely enjoying the process. Like you're getting fed something by having this attention given to you. And I think that that's what sort of, the narcissist and slash the con man kind of have is they're able to take these little scenarios of truth and they're able to capitalize on them in a way that the average human being would just never do. It's just, we would just be like, oh, this little thing happened and so what?
Yeah, 100%. And what you just described there, so everything you've just now described speaks to other things that you've mentioned so far in our conversation. Power. Think of the power of standing there and doing that to you. So there's narcissism, there's that just sense of power. And you brought up something that's really important, and that is that narcissism is at play. Researchers have shown with confidence men, white collar criminals that have been convicted for con games and so forth, they do score higher in narcissism than the average person. There is certainly research to support what you're saying. And again, the book, it's obviously again, New York Times bestseller, it's an older book now, it was written at the dawn of the post-truth era and it was written in 1979. It's called The Culture of Narcissism. It's, a global bestseller. And one of the quotes in there from Christopher Lash, who's the author, he says, by using some accurate details to imply a misleading picture of the whole, the artful propagandist makes truth the principal form of falsehood. So those micro truths become the principal form of the holistic falsehood. Now, again, the book itself is called The Culture of Narcissism. So it's actually, you're really tying together a lot of the different threads of this. And because you can't exclude narcissism from the overall conversation we're having with the crisis that we're facing, where we're at, in our civilization at the moment. Because again, Jean Twenge research, she's, and I hope I'm pronouncing her right, her last name correctly. It's Twenge. But her team has shown, significant upticks in polarization politically and so forth. But the other thing that she has shown, which has been backed up by other researchers and replicated, is this uptick in narcissism in society. So when you see personality tests that have been conducted for decades, and they pretty much stayed right in the same zone with regard to narcissism and empathy, but in the early 2000s, all of a sudden you see a marked and notable change, significant increases in narcissism and declining. Of course, empathy and narcissism do not rise together.
Right.
They're polar opposites. So as one rises, the other falls. And that's exactly what they showed. And again, these are based on large data sets in North America, and it's been shown elsewhere as well. So if you have that, that's not a healthy indicator in society. Take an increase in narcissism, and add some of the other things we've discussed, and shake and stir. You know, what have you got? It's something that we need to really take seriously and contend with.
Welcome back. I'm talking with award-winning author Alan C. Logan, who is sharing the importance of understanding power dynamics and how propaganda is constructed and spread when it comes to building our own personal knowledge base. And then that leads me to the sort of conversation around health. And, you know, I'm one of those people that I believe that the truth lies in between, right? It usually between, so I'm not very polarized in my belief system. I believe that it's somewhere in the middle. And when I say the middle, I don't mean the safe ground. I just mean it's not usually what we think it is. Yeah. And so I'm always fascinated by anybody who's, you know, either doing research or who is broaching the subject of looking at things differently than maybe how, you know, mainstream society might want or be comfortable looking at things. And so, you know, we're coming to a point now where, you know, they're talking about, for example, trust science, right? It's the big sort of buzzword. You know, we're going to trust science. We're going to trust science. And that's great. We need to trust evidence-based science. But at the same time, that's giving science power. And that power then, if by the equation we were talking about earlier, means in order to maintain power, there's a chance that truth isn't always front and center. And so I'm nervous about how we move through the next number of years with things like this pandemic, and then also things like global warming. You know, how do we know to trust? You know, how does the average human being, you know, figure this all out? Because it feels like we're kind of left on our own a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's really, that is now the heart of the matter. Science, of course, is a very slippery term, because the question becomes, whose science? What
exactly
science?
Exactly.
You know, and this is where it gets tricky, because you need to understand the source. And for me, I've certainly, in, you know, my own education, my own research, my own writing, you know, I've really arrived at a conclusion where we really need to have early life education on understanding how misinformation spreads, how propaganda is constructed and spread, but also, and part of that is always understanding source material and understanding power dynamics, right? Because we have to always question whose science, because there are plenty of front groups that have been shown, you know, over the years. I would encourage any listener to have a look at the Citizens for Fire Safety story, which is documented in various writings, Los Angeles Times and a few documentaries. And basically, just as just a surrogate marker of how this operates, it pretended to be, you know, a real science-based community organization, and it turned out to be nothing of the sort. It was being run by a profit-generating entity. And this is the problem with what you see in science, that it's who's wielding the research paper in their hand and to what end? So I think part of what we're discussing right here, you know, with that is understanding how things operate and the difference between really high quality information that's going to promote health and well-being across society at all levels, yet also being able to understand how to appreciate the way that things can be manipulated with power dynamics in place. I think that's really important. And then also just sort of in the, just, this is a little bit of a digression, but it's not, in the sense that when you teach young people about power dynamics, they're more likely to respond and take action. Like, for example, if you teach young teens in particular, right? I think that's the age where the research actually bears this out. You teach them the power dynamics and the ways in which multinationals foist unhealthy product on communities, especially disadvantaged communities. And when they understand those power dynamics, they're more likely to actually eat healthy, to feel like they're being hoodwinked. And there are now several studies that show this. Rather than simply standing at the front of the classroom, presenting a didactic education about, hey, this is what the Canada Health Guide looks like. This is the pyramid. This is the rainbow, the, you know, whatever they use at the moment. You're far and away more likely to get results when you actually teach from the perspective of power dynamics, because quite often there's a lot at play. Now, with regard to the search for truth, we can't do that with stone-like rigidity, because if you do that, if you're unwilling to accept truths as approximations based on the limits of a certain knowledge at a given time, you end up with authoritarianism. So, you know, we have to, this is the really, really nuanced but yet critical point. And you're asking, I think, the million-dollar question. I don't have all the answers to that, but I do know there are ways to do that early on and early in life. And the research, the nice thing about it is the inoculation, as it's called, against, you know, we're talking a lot about vaccines these days, but there's actually research that shows that if you inoculate young people against misinformation, which is to say you teach them how to understand the techniques of propaganda and how it's spread, they actually are, it's actually an empowering thing. Like, it's really wonderful, because then they can make their own informed choices, and that's really important. So you don't want to teach people what's right and what's wrong. You want to teach them the techniques. And also, it's a really a form of inoculation. And there was a lot of research in this realm prior to World War II, for obvious reasons, when there was a really important need for society to be able to understand how propaganda works. And they had great success in the classrooms, but they were not teaching it with a stone-like rigidity. They were simply – and what was great was that the students did not become cynical, because the argument against it, Brian – If you argue, hey, we've got to teach young people how to separate, you know, truth from fiction, the techniques of misinformation, fake news, propaganda, you would think that if you did that, well, then they'd all become cynical and they wouldn't trust anything. They wouldn't believe anything. But the available research shows that that's not what happens. You actually empower, through that form of education, you actually empower young people. And again, then they can make informed choices.
Okay, well, that is a great segue into a challenge I have for you.
Yep.
So my challenge for you is, because I know that President-elect Joe Biden's wife, Jill Biden, has just announced that she's going to maintain her education career while she's in the White House as First Lady. And so you need to get in touch with her, and you need to convince her through education that the thing that she can leave this planet with after her 4 or 8 years in the White House is an education initiative that teaches young people about the power dynamic and how to navigate this world in a safe and healthy way. So you should go forth and do that, Alan.
I'm on it, Brian. You know what? I'm going to listen to you, because our society, since time immemorial, you are the leader and I am going to follow.
Oh, I appreciate that. But I just mean, because this is the second conversation we've had around this, that you've brought that up. And I think that there's a lot of a lot of resonance behind what you're saying there. And I think that that is a way out. And I believe right now, with what has happened in the last 4 years, I think that people like her and people in positions of power will be much more receptive to that type of conversation of the need for us to help young people start to have a rational way of understanding the power dynamics and the choices that they're being asked to make.
I think it's a wonderful platform, and it's a necessary platform, because look, I think we would all agree we can't continue the way we are right now. It's just not sustainable. It's not viable.
No. And so back to your book, you know, I don't know how much you want to talk about it, but I think you should. Because as I said, I just, like, if I was going to send you back an email after you sent me that advanced copy, I would have sent back the word wow. Like, I would have just gone wow. Like, you know, it, because I had talked with you and I knew what the storyline was and I knew what it was about, I kind of had a little bit of a heads up, but I'm still just blown away with, one, how you were able to uncover this, the sort of serendipity of it all for how you got to the truth behind this story, but also just how, as you mentioned, you know, Broadway musical and movie and et cetera, it's like it's an industry was created on something that was sort of the fraud of the fraud, so to speak, right? It's, yes. You know, it's not even like it's based on, yeah, it just, I don't know. I found it very fascinating. I just, a great read, and I just kept turning pages because I just kept wanting to get like, where, like, how crazy is this?
Yeah. I'll say this much on, you know, the greatest hoax on earth, catching truth while we can. I think the subtitle should give the listeners a clear indication as to what the book is about. And there's the catching truth while we can. Basically, this story emerged, and I'll keep it brief because I know we probably don't have that much time, but while I was researching and writing Self-Styled, the true story of Dr. Robert Vernon Spears, who was on the front page of the New York Times, and just this incredible untold story that really hadn't been given much attention in the literary world. And along the way, as people would read the manuscript, they kept comparing the story to Catch Me If You Can, Frank Abagnale's autobiography. Mm-hmm. So being someone that likes to turn over stones, I thought it might be interesting to try to see, because with Robert Vernon Spears, I could go into public record, find the records, find the newspaper articles, court records, genealogy, you name it, everything. It was there. You could peel it back. And you know, if someone's a great con man, as Spears was, you can actually find these things in the records as they unfolded. As he did things, there was reporting. As he did things, there was police records. And then I started to see the absolute absence of that with Abagnale's story. I mean, just like really nothing, which really mm-hmm. was just like, this is really kind of weird. You know, there's has to be reporting. So I found a tiny, tiny little article through the Genealogy Bank newspapers listing. So they have fully scanned newspapers there, not as many as newspapers.com, but different newspapers, local reporting, local. So in 1969, there was this tiny little 2x2 article that said pilot, air quotes around pilot, arrested for vagrancy. And this was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Guy was dressed up in a TWA uniform, and this family, the Parks family of Baton Rouge, evidently he had defrauded them. And I said, wow. And Frank Abagnale was mentioned by name. He was the guy in the pilot's uniform. I'm like, okay. So it's clear that he at least dressed as a TWA pilot at one point. He was arrested in Baton Rouge. And I just made it my business to find out who is this Parks family. And mm-hmm. once I discovered the Parks family, the victims in the case are deceased, but the daughter is very much alive. She was a flight attendant at the time in 1969 and worked for Delta Airlines. So I made contact with Paula Parks, the Delta Airlines flight attendant. And when we spoke, I said, "Do you know Frank Abagnale?" And she said, "Wow, do I have a story for you?" And we built up trust together. Her family had kept letters under lock and key for 50 years from 1969. And I contacted her in 2019. And because we built up trust with one another, she gave those letters to me. These were written from Abagnale from jail in Baton Rouge. And suffice it to say that the content within those letters let the cat out of the bag and allowed me to seamlessly reconcile the things that he said in those letters with public records. And once I got a start on some of the public records, they led to others and others and others and others to the point where I was able to document this guy's movements from 1965 to 1975. Then I ended up finding his manager at the time in his heyday when his autobiography came out, which sold evidently by his telling 3 million copies, but it was most certainly a New York Times bestseller in 1980, that's for sure. And the manager, when I spoke with him, I called up the manager, Mark Zinder, and he was surprised. I said, "I've been working to try to separate fact from fiction in the autobiography, Catch Me If You Can." And his words to me was, "I've been waiting for this call for over 30 years." And he also had a hell of a story to tell, all of which was reconciled and supported by the record. So, in short, everything that happened between 1965 and 1975 is wholly different than what you might think. And it is equally phenomenal. That's the amazing thing. So it's not just a debunking exercise. You know, there's not really a lot of joy in just simply debunking something. It's actually what happened in its stead. And that's where you get slack-jawed about it, you know.
Yeah, that's the part that I find, like, everything in the book, as you walk us through those years and what the truth was, it would be one thing if we didn't know the story, but to know the end story, to know the movie, to know what's happened, to see the fame and the fortune that has come his way is, on some level, it's kind of so in line with what we've just been experiencing with Trump. You know, even though Trump came into this world with a silver spoon in his mouth, you know, the man was a con. He cheated and he took from people. He lied and he's just put himself in the White House, right? And that's the part where I'm fascinated by, which is like, you know, because I want to believe in karma, you know? But when I look at some of these characters, I go, you know, I mean, the only satisfaction I've gotten around the whole concept of karma when it comes to these people that they just do, it doesn't seem to, they never have their day in court, so to speak, is I had a spiritual person once read me a quote that said that when you die, you do not have your life flash before your eyes. When you die, you have how you made others feel flash across your emotional body. And if you made people feel good, you're in heaven. And if you made people feel bad, you're in hell. And that's the sort of payday, so to speak, that happens to us when we die, is that you have to reckon with your life and how you made others feel. And so then I'm like, okay, now, okay, if that's true, if I can believe that that's true, then at least there's some hope that these people, you know, get some day in court over what they've done. But it must just be devastating for the victims of these types of people to see them go on and on and on to more and more fame and fortune right before their eyes, knowing that one, this person's a liar, two, this person cheated me. And yeah, I just,
I'm really glad you brought that up, and because it just briefly, it's just really worth underscoring and putting some exclamation points after it, because the entire enterprise of Catch Me If You Can is what's been described by one journalist, an arts and media journalist, after the film and certainly the play, as a quote victimless romp. But it's actually not. When you understand the true story of the Parks family and others, you actually see the pain and the suffering to which they were exposed, because you have the initial criminal activity, grotesque betrayal, and then you have them sitting by watching this on the Tonight Show. You have claims on major television networks that this individual never ripped off an individual, never ripped off mom and pop shops and so forth, whereas in reality, that's what happened to them. And yet they had no voice. They tried to tell people about it, and eventually they were silenced. And then the film came out and they had to deal with it again. Then the Broadway play came out and they had to deal with it again. So it's just like this, it's this constant, and you sort of feel powerless. You know, Paula Parks is a really wonderful person, and with a phenomenal story. I mean, all I'm doing here is just having the absolute honor to be able to carry their stories forward, because it's not really my book. It's Paula Parks' book and others who had to sit and watch this. It's their book.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, the book is really not about Abagnale per se. It's actually about the lives of the people that he put himself into and that he shook and stirred up.
Yeah.
That's what the book's about. But Paula's mother, who's now deceased, the true victim in this, as readers will see why, her nickname was Sparky. And after this all went down, Paula told me when I was chatting with her, she said, you know, my mother's nickname was always Sparky, but after this happened, she lost her spark.
Mm-hmm.
I dedicated the book to her parents. And she's just the wonderful thing is about, I mean, I think readers will really relate to Paula and what she went through. This is a really courageous woman. I have to tell you, along the way, along the path of this quest, turning over stones, I found many remarkable people who wanted to tell their stories. But I also found people who did not. Victims that said, hey, I just prefer not to talk about this. And that was fine, and that needs to be respected. So that was done too. But you know, he often said, and he was talking more about, you know, the different places he claimed to work. He claimed to work at a hospital for a year, he claimed to be the attorney general for a year and a professor for two semesters and so on. And there were some really great journalists who tried to debunk this and go to all the sources, the places that he said he worked at, and they of course couldn't find anybody. To say, yeah, that guy was here. And his argument was always, well, they'd be too embarrassed to say so.
Right.
That's why they deny that I was there working with them. As we discussed in the beginning, Brian, it's probably a good way to go full circle.
Yeah, no, it is.
Always tiny grains of truth to the larger holistic falsehood.
Yeah, yeah. And you've done a great job bringing that to the surface. And you know, and you know what? I just hope that, you know, your book gets out and the world reads it, and there's some, you know, resolution for the people that were harmed by this. And maybe there's a few famous people in Hollywood that could help, you know, say thank you to those people, because, you know, if you profit from something that you didn't know was hurting people, that's one thing. But once you know you've profited from something that has harmed other human beings, you should make amends.
Well, that takes us back to karma, doesn't it?
Yeah. It really does. And let's hope that that happens, because, in this Me Too movement, right? In the era, in the Me Too era of, just, hashtag, karma.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. I
Yeah.
mean, and I think the story here is just remarkable. And this is a powerful individual, but once I realized the truth, you have to go into this kind of unafraid. If not me, who? If not
Yeah.
now, when?
Well, good for you, Alan. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of this book that you've written, and I've also really enjoyed our conversation. And I'm going to be oh so proud of you when you convince Jill Biden to start an education program.
I'm on it, Brian. Always a pleasure chatting. I really look forward to catching up with you again.
Yeah, it's great. I appreciate your time, and we'll have all of the links to the book and your website and all that stuff in the show notes. And until that time, I wish you nothing but the best. Thank you, Alan.
Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Well, that's another episode of Listen In. Thanks for being. Please subscribe, leave comments, or head on over to our website at listeninpod.com. That's listen with two N's, pod.com, where you'll find episode notes, links to anything that we talked about in this episode, and you can connect with us about being a guest on Listen In.